This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Robert Brown is one of the most influential North Carolinians that you've never heard of. He had a pretty humble start in High Point, where he was born and raised. He was among the city's first African-American police officers in the 1950s. But he moved on quickly, first as a federal drug enforcement officer and then as an advisor to some of the world's most powerful people, Martin Luther King Jr., Richard Nixon, Nelson Mandela, and John F. Kennedy, and that is only a partial list. He is now the founder and CEO of B&C International, one of the oldest and most respected minority-owned consulting firms in the nation. Robert Brown, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell me about growing up in High Point.
Well, it was sometimes very difficult. We grew up poor. My grandmother raised me, and we lived in the poor section of town, and it was sometimes very difficult. But my grandmother was very innovative. She was a woman who had very little education. I think the third grade, she could she learned how to write her name and things like that. But she was a woman of great wisdom, and so she directed me in so many ways and so many things, not only when I was a child, but even after I grew up into manhood. I followed her direction and her faith. I adopted her faith, and it just became a part of me. You know, everything I did, everything, everywhere I went, wherever in the world it has been, I'd always be wondering, and I always do, even now. I wonder what Mama would do. I wonder what she would say, because there were so many, many, many things that we went through, so many difficulties.
She was a hard worker.
She was a very hard worker. She originally was working for the old Southern Railroad. She was a maid in the High Point train station. She was the maid. Kept the place clean and called all the trains. When the trains would be coming in, that was my grandmother's voice that you would hear, because she had a loud voice. She was a gospel singer, and so she could call. You could hear all over town when my grandmother would be called.
No PA system, I guess.
No PA system. No, nothing like that. And so she was, but she was a good woman, smart, and she had visions of all the different kinds of things.
What did she want for you? Did she tell you? Did she give you some direction?
Oh, she gave me direction all the time from the time I was a little boy. I recall, even now, when I go back through old pictures of me as a little boy, from the time that I remember having my first picture made, I was about 4 years old. And it's one of my prized possessions now. But my grandmother took me downtown to get a picture made, and she dressed me up in a little sailor suit with short pants. And she had my grandfather to tie a tie, put a tie on that sailor suit, and I had a big tie on, and I'm sitting up there. I have that picture now, and I remember it. I remember her taking me downtown. It's amazing how you can remember things that far
back. Well, you also, I guess, picked up some of that work ethic. You were cutting lawns for a while to make money, pulling those no power mowers, right? You had real mowers with steel wheels.
My grandfather had an old lawnmower, an old lawnmower, and he kept it greased and the blade sharpened on it. But it had steel wheels. I had never seen one before or since. But that's the old lawnmower that my brother and I would cut our grass with, and then we'd go around in the middle class white neighborhoods, and we'd knock on doors, and we'd be pushing that lawnmower and say, "You all need any grass cut today or any work done?" And particularly during the summer months, you know, invariably somebody would say, "Yeah, cut this grass. I want you to pull up some weeds around here, straighten up some junk I got in the back." And so that's the way we hustled. But we also had, both of us had shine boxes. And so we would go up on the corner of Wren and Washington Street, where there are a lot of pool rooms and all that. And we'd sit out there on Fridays and Saturdays and wait for people to come by and want the shoes shine. And that's where we shine shoes.
Well, you quickly moved out of the service industry and the landscaping industry, decided to go to school. You were going to A&T, taking sociology, right, for a while?
Yeah, I went. My first year of college was at Virginia Union University in Richmond. I had I got a couple of scholarships there, and I went to school there for my first year, and I did very well. And I loved Virginia Union. I loved the people there. I loved the school. But almost all the way through when I was there, both my grandparents got sick. Mm. And I decided it would be better for me, if I'm going to keep going to school, to go come home and go closer to school and stay at home with them and try to get to A&T every day. So I did that. And every day when I was going to school at A&T, I would either, if I had the money, I'd get the bus, which was like 35 cents or something like 25, 30 cents. And I'd ride over there downtown to the bus station, and then I'd get off and walk to A&T. And that would be about 2 or 3 miles down the road. And but many mornings, what I would do, because I wouldn't have the money, I would go out to an area called Five Points in High Point, not too far away where my office is now, and I would thumb, because that was the main old 29. That was the only road to Greensboro. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be out there thumbing, and I never missed a time when somebody didn't pick me up to go when I was out there thumbing, riding to Greensboro.
It's interesting to me that you were going there, and I think it was A&T where you took that sociology course, and that's where you got the idea to become a police officer.
Yeah, well, it happened in such a way where I was taking a course in sociology under Dr. Robinson, we were studying about community relations and all that, what causes problems. And one of the things that was brought up is that police sometimes go off on a deep end and all this. And so I came home on a bus one night, and I was reading the High Point Enterprise. It was an old paper on the bus, and I always loved papers. I still read 10 or 15 newspapers every day, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Raleigh News, Observer, High Point Enterprise, Greensboro Daily News, and others. subscribed to many of them. I've been doing that for the last 40 years.
Wow.
And so I was reading this paper in High Point Enterprise, and it had an ad in there saying we need more policemen, and they were going to have an exam that night up on Wren Street, and that anybody was welcome who was 21 years older, who had graduated from high school. So I said, we're studying this stuff about police community relations. I said, I need to run by there. So I walked from the bus station, which was maybe about 10 blocks over there where they were having the exam. I walked up there and I said, asked the guy who was conducting everything, I said, can I take this exam? And he said, are you 21 years old? I said, yes, sir, I just turned 21. And he said, well, come on in. Here's a paper. Fill these papers out right here and come on in and take the exam. So I filled the papers out and I took the exam. And the exam was not. It was hard, but not that hard, you know. And so when I finished, I said, oh, I've learned a lot. I can write another paper, and I'm sure I'm going to get an A on this course. So I just kept on moving. Well, about 4 or 5 days later, maybe, I came home from school one evening, and my grandmother said, Bobby, Captain Johnson from the police department has been down here looking for you. He said he wants to talk to you. She said, son, are you in any kind of trouble? I said, no, ma'am, Mom, I haven't done anything. I'm not in any kind of trouble. She said, well, why are the police looking for you? I said, I don't know, Mama. And she said he left his card, and he said he wants you to call him when you got in. So we didn't have a telephone, so I had to go across the street to the Dunlap house to use the phone. So I call him, and he says, "Robert, you home? I need to talk to you." I said, "Yes, sir, I'll be here." He said, "Well, I'll come right on down there." So about 20, 30 minutes later, I'm sitting out on the porch, so I decided not to go back in the house because my grandmother was so nervous about what was going to happen. So I'm sitting on the porch, and he drives up with another policeman with him, and he comes up. And he said, "You Robert?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "My name is Captain Johnson." He said, "I'm captain of detectives for the police department." And he introduced the other fellow with him. He said, "You're not in any trouble if that's what your people are thinking." He said, "You took our police exam." And he said, "You made the highest mark anybody's ever made on that test." And he said, "We want to offer you a job as a policeman." And I almost fell through the floor. I could not believe it. I mean, that was like something from the moon or something. So I said, "Oh, really?" I said, when does this take place?" He said, "Oh, if you take the job, you can go to work right now."
We'll find out if you took the job and what your grandma thought when she finally got the news when we continue our conversation with Robert Brown of High Point, North Carolina, a consultant to not only businesses but some of the most influential people in the world. We'll hear more of that story on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking with Robert Brown, founded one of the oldest and most respected minority-owned consulting firms in the nation, BNC International. We'll find out how you got to that, because it was a long road through many, many influential people. But we left you on the porch of your home in High Point, somewhere in the middle of the 1950s, with your grandma and your grandfather peeking out the window with two police officers standing next to you having a conversation. What were they thinking? I just can't imagine, you know.
Well, I think they were worried that, that the police had come there to pick me up for something, whatever. And then that was always serious when police came to a black household. You know, it was usually very serious, and anything could happen.
You took the job.
Well, I took the job. I thought about it a little bit, and I said, "Well, you know, I'll go back to school," because I was about to just finish in the next few days, A&T, the year that I spent there. And I said, "I'll go back to school. Maybe I'll take this job for a couple of years and either go to school at night or return and go to school next couple of years or something." And one thing led to another, and I did very well. Very well there. And while there, I was assigned to work with two federal narcotic agents. And I did very well. And when we were finished with that assignment, they were asking me, how would I like to be a federal agent? Hmm. And I said, "Well, I haven't finished college yet." And I knew that a college degree was a requirement. And they said, "Well, you excel in so many areas that we think we can get that overruled." And I said, "What? You know, I never heard anything like that before, particularly for a black person." And this was the 1950s. You know, everything was segregated. You know?
Well, let me stop you there, because I do want to get to that decision and finish that conversation you had with the federal agents. But yeah, the 1950s, the High Point police are recruiting you, an African-American man, to serve on that police force. You had to be among the very first in the South on a segregated police force.
I think High Point was the very first in the South to hire black policemen. And by the time they hired me, they had hired, five or six at least.
Did those officers talk with you while you were thinking about your decision? Did you?
Well, I talked to one of them. His name was O.H. Leek. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first. And I went to him and I said, "Mr. Leek, you know, they consider me for policemen. You know, what do you think?" he said, "Oh, Bob, you would be a great addition to the force." He said, "You know, it's a very good job, and it's going to get better because things are going to get better." He was very optimistic. Wow. And he became one of my best friends because he became a mentor. He taught me how to play golf, and he did a lot of things for me.
What was the thinking in High Point at the time? Why do you think they made this decision to integrate their police department?
Well, when I went on, it had been integrated for several years, but I think they fired their first black policeman in 1943 or 42 or something like that. And so I think they wanted to make sure that they had some representatives from the black community. I think that's the kind of leadership that we had, even way back then. It's the kind of leadership we need now in the state. We have some of that kind of leadership, but you know, I think we need more of that in our city governments, more in our state legislature. You know, that all people have worth, and that you've got to include all people and give all people an opportunity to pursue their rightful place in society. You can't block people out, or you can't just have something where you're going to have it for all of one group of people. That's never going to work. It worked for a while. It worked to your advantage for a while, but for all time, that's never going to work. Yeah. Because first of all, it's not Christ-like. I mean, the Bible that I read and the books that I read, and in particular, all the Bible teaching me that all persons have worth, and that we're all created by our Creator with the same inalienable rights, and that we should pursue that. That's what America has been trying to evolve to. I mean, we didn't start out like that. We started out as a slave nation and all of that. But if we recall that the first person who died in the Revolutionary War to make this country safe and to make it a democracy was Crispus Attucks, who was the first person, not the first black. Yes. He happened to be a black man, but he was the first person to die to save this country. And I think somehow or another we just ditched that. You know, that doesn't seem to mean too much anymore.
We forget it over and over again and have to remind ourselves. So now there you are at High Point. You're doing so well in the narcotics division working with federal agents that you're recruited to become a federal agent, a federal narcotics agent.
Yeah.
Right? Tell us about that decision and what happened next.
Well, I get a call from my grandmother one day, and she says, "Bobby, I want you to come by here." She called the police station. The police said, "Your grandmother's on the phone." I just happened to be up there. And I spoke to her. I said, "Yeah, Mama, what's the matter?" She said, "Bobby, I need you to come by here as soon as possible." So I got in a police car. We had been up there. We had arrested somebody or something, and we were booking them. So I went by my grandmother's house, which wasn't a long way from the police department. And she said, "Bobby," said, "everybody's talking about that you got to be in some kind of trouble because the FBI is going around asking about you and whether or not you've been in trouble or and what you're doing and this, that, and the other." She said, "What in the world is going on?" I said, "Mama," I said, "what they're doing is investigating me and doing an investigation of me because there's some possibility that I may be hired as a federal agent." And she said, "Bobby, you're not going to leave High Point, are you?" I said, "Well, Mama, if we get the opportunity," I said, "we may go there to New York or somewhere else to live for a while, but I'll be coming home on a regular basis." I said, "I'm never going to leave High Point." And she said, "Okay, then." So about 3 or 4 weeks later, I get this letter in the mail. This was June of 1956, where they were from the commissioner himself saying that I had been appointed as a federal agent and I would report to 90 Church Street, the federal building there, to Mr. George Gaffney, who was the district supervisor in the New York area in the Northeast, and that I would be working there as an agent. That's where my office would be in. And I was shocked, even though I knew that it was a possibility. I was really shocked. So I prepared. I told them, people at the police department, and they were elated. They couldn't believe it. And so the next few weeks after I got that notice, I packed up and went to New York.
What kind of work were you doing in New York then?
Well, when I first got there, I was just, I was given a lot of briefings by different agents who were working on specialized cases with the Bureau. But they had decided before I got there that they wanted me to work on the Mafia. And so they briefed me fully on a lot of that. And then they had to test me in the street to see if I would be streetwise enough to be involved in that kind of thing. So when they did that, I came through there with flying colors. And then they started to give me other kinds of assignments, and they assigned a guy to work with me, and then they assigned what was called a special employee, a SE, to work with me to make cases.
Now, were you doing undercover work, or?
I was doing a lot of undercover work
with them, and of course, this is the heroin trade now is peaking. With
that's right, it was
so
big time.
Got Mafia, the Genovese family is growing in power because of the heroin trade post World War II.
That's exactly right.
So this is a pretty dangerous assignment.
It was a very dangerous assignment, but I ended up over the next 3 years making more cases than anybody in the Bureau. In fact, the biggest a case that I had a part in was the Vito Genovese case, which was the biggest mafia case ever prosecuted in the world. And I testified in that trial and so forth. And it was some tough,
Was your life ever in danger? Were you really
my life
some
was
close
in danger
calls?
Many times. Yeah. Many times. In fact, for many years during that time and after, a number of years after I left the Bureau, I carried two guns with me all the time, just in case anybody had any ideas. I wanted to make sure that I gave them as much as they came for. You know, I would give it back. And so, but there's a sort of an unwritten rule in the among the agencies and with the Bureau that you can't strike an agent. Because if you do, there's poxy on your house in many ways that I can't even explain.
It will come back.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so tell us about leaving that. You're very successful, but you didn't stay a drug enforcement officer.
No, because I'm one. I was just I knew that I didn't want to spend 20 years there and retire. But they were telling me all the time, Bob, this is a great opportunity for you and all this. One day, my wife and I are down in Greenwich Village in the summertime, and they spread books out all over the place in the summer and fall. And I'm looking, we love to read. And so I'm looking at these books, and I pick up this book called Effective Public Relations by Scott Cutler. And I fan through it, and I said, oh, this looks interesting. I think I want to read this. So the book was either 50 cent or something like that. It wasn't much, 25, 50 cent. And I bought the book, and I brought it, took it home, and I read it. And then I said, it's interesting. So a week later, I read it again. And then I said, this sounds like something I want to do, but I better know more about this. So I read it again. And then I started looking up. I went to the public library, and I started looking up all information about public relations and what it was all about and so forth. And then after that, I went home one day, and I told my wife, my late wife, that I said, Sally, I want to go into the public relations business. And she looked at me. She said, you lost your mind. Said, you don't know anything about no public relations. She said, you read all them books. She said, but it's more than that, Robert. You know, that's these people have been in this. And she said, everything is so segregated, so they're not even going to let you inside the door.
Well, that's it. You're going to have to talk to these white corporations, all led by white men. This is the Mad Men era of, in America. And you're going to this black man's going to walk into this board of directors and say, I've got some advice for you on how you can market your product.
And the sit-ins that just started, you know, this kind of thing, it just started in America. And I told her, I said, look, based on what I want to do, I think I can be very helpful. I think I can be a force for change and show companies what they ought to be doing and how they ought to be doing it. And she said, well, look at all these other people out here. There are more people who got more experience and education and everything else than you have. How do you think you're going to do that? I said, you know, I think God has endowed me with a certain sensibility that I can do this. I think it's something that I can excel at. And so I eventually sold her. She wasn't being sold. But over the next 2 or 3 months, I sold her. Wow. And then she said, I will go. I'll go back home. And she didn't want to come back to North Carolina because everything was segregated.
Yeah.
She had a very good job. I had a very good job. I could retire in 20 years. And there were only a handful of blacks who had that kind of job in America. And everybody, when I came back, everybody thought I had lost my mind.
But you turned that segregated experience into your success story, and you can take us back to the time when your grandmother took you to Woolworths when you were a little boy.
Yeah.
And then you can bring us forward to show us how you turned it on its head.
Well, my grandmother we would go downtown shopping, and we'd do most of our shopping in S.H. Kresk's and Kresge and Woolworth. But she liked Woolworth the best because she felt that they had the best goods and the best buys. So eventually we'd end up in Woolworth always. And so we go to Woolworth on this particular occasion. I'm just a little boy. And I said, I want me some water. So I went over there and I started drinking out of the fountain. And my grandmother saw me drinking out of the white water fountain. She said, Bobby, come here, boy. Don't you drink out of that other fountain. And so I said, okay, Mama. So I went over there and got some water out of the other fountain, the colored fountain. And then I went back after I finished drinking water. I said, Mama, why we got colored water and white water? I said, all the water looked the same. It's the same color and everything. She said, Bobby, that's just some white people who don't want us to drink with them or be with them in any kind of way. She said, but some of these days, boy, that's going to change. She said, that's going to change, Bobby. It's not going to be like that always. And I said, yes, ma'am. So I just, and then here, fast forward it to a couple of decades and a half forward. And Woolworth becomes a major client of mine. I worked with them for 33 years. Worked with their board of directors, their CEO, and their CEOs, because they had two or three of them at the time, and their board. And they had some of the most powerful financial people and political people on their board in the world. And they kind of adopted me. And
what kind of advice were you giving them?
Oh, what I was saying is that we got to change. I said, all these things have to change. And then I would go around. I told them what I had to do. And they didn't know because we had not been confronted with anything like this ever in America. So we were cutting new ground. But I told them, I said, I have to go around to all these Woolworth stores all over the South and some in the North. And just assess the situation to see what's going on and what's happening. We have any blacks employed and all this. Well, what I found was we had some blacks employed, you know, as janitors and so forth. but no sales clerks. A few in the north, but usually they were all white. All the management was white. And I just told them, this is not going to work. This is not sustainable. So we have to try to do other kinds of things. We got to integrate. And then at the headquarters office there, they got this huge building in Manhattan. And I'm going through the building, and I don't see any black secretaries and no black executives. So I just started telling them, I said, you know, we got to put on a program to hire some blacks in different jobs. I said, we got to hire some black managers. I said, we got to have a black on the board of directors and all this. And so they became one of the first companies to have, first mega companies to have a black on this board of directors. And then we went out and recruited different people to serve in executive positions, the first one being Aubrey Lewis, who had been a star football player at the University of Notre Dame, but who lived over in Montclair, New Jersey. And he was a nice fella, and he knew about how to deal with people and everything. So that worked out. We transformed them. That's what happened.
We're going to talk about that transformation and how you transformed yourself from a business consultant to a political consultant as my conversation with Robert Brown of High Point, North Carolina, continues on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're meeting Robert Brown today, CEO and founder of B&C International, talking about your success with Woolworths and other companies in the early 60s, getting them to transform their business culture and some of their marketing strategies. Did you have much resistance, I would think, like at Woolworths, for instance? How did that go when you made those suggestions?
I didn't have any resistance at all with their top management people. But as I went around the country, they had me going around to every region of the country, meeting with their vice presidents and general managers in charge of different regions. And at various times when I would meet with some of them, they would tell me that this is something that they didn't think they could do, you know, that the local laws and this and that and the other. And I would tell them that this is something that we have to do. We're going to have to learn how to get this done in order to save the company. I said, what's important, saving the company or saving some idea to segregation and discrimination somebody had a long time ago that they want to pursue? I said, things are changing. Things will change. And I said, we can either get in line with the change or we can be destroyed. Mm. We can go under. I said, one way or the other. Well, some people accepted that very well and others did not. They were somewhat resistant. But those, I made special note of those who were resistant. And I would take it up with, the CEO and the chairman of the board. I would have regular lunches with them in New York. And various times I'd be on the phone with them. If it was something fairly serious that I covered, I'd be on the phone with them. And with I was working also with the largest PR firm in the world. Name of it was Carl Byer and Associates, BYOIR. And they were the people who were handling the general account. And I was constantly meeting and talking with the CEO there. And their executive vice president, a fellow by the name of Bob Wood and George Hammond. I was in touch with them almost every day.
And, of course, the civil rights movement now, what we would call the later civil rights movement, Dr. King, the SCLC, this is in full swing. And so what you were saying to these managers had a lot of credibility. There were sit-ins. There were protests. It was clear that something was happening. Tell us about that and how you met Dr. King.
Oh, yeah. I took it upon myself to go all over the country, north, south, east, and west, and to meet different people. But accidentally, I met Dr. King. I was in Atlanta having a lunch with Stanley Scott, who was one of the editors of the Atlanta Daily World, a black newspaper there. Their family had that paper for 7,500 years. And Y.T. Walker walks in, And Stan said, "Bob, do you know why T. Walker?" I said, "No, I don't know him." He said, "Well, he is the executive vice president and chief of staff for Martin Luther King Jr." And he said, "You need to know him." So he takes me over to his table, and we say hello and so forth. And we hit it off immediately. And he says, "You know, you say you're in the public relations business." He said, "We need some help at SCLC." He said, "Dr. King is in town today." He said, "When you and Stan finish lunch, why don't you come on by our office? It's up in the next block." And I said, "Okay." He said, "I'd like very much you to meet Dr. King and say hello to him." So when we finished, I went up there, and he took me right in to see Dr. King. And Dr. King, Wyatt told me a little bit about you, and he said, "You working with some of these big companies?" I said, "Yes, sir, Doc." And he said, "Well, we need some help too, Bob." He said, "We don't have no money, and we're meeting with resistance everywhere, and we need somebody like you to help us." And I said, "Well, I'll do whatever I can to be helpful to you."
You helped him with fundraising, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he said, "Well, we need money worse in the worst way." So from then on, I started working with him, channeling money into him and that kind of thing. And there were many ways that I would do that. I would call up people that I knew who were influential and who had money and have them send money to him. And then since I had a lot of flexibility with my accounts and everything, what I would do if they needed something, like if they wanted to have a big dinner for their board or for a regional meeting or something, they didn't have no money to fund it. So what I would do is pay for it. And then I would charge one of my clients, many times Woolworth or A&P or one of them that I was working for luncheon or something that I needed for public relations purposes and so forth.
You always disclosed it. I mean, they knew
it. I disclosed it.
Can I tell you how exquisite it is to be looking at the man who was working with Woolworths and Martin Luther King at the same time at the peak of the civil rights movement?
Yeah.
And actually getting permission to take money from one to fund the other to get this movement going. So we imagine this battle as sort of across the lines, but there were key people like yourself who were working with everybody on what we would consider both sides. I mean, if you think about the sit-ins at Woolworths, clearly they were changing their culture to make this transition work. We hardly ever get to meet people.
Well,
like
one of the things that is very interesting, and there are remnants of information around all over the place now. But one of the things that was very interesting, Dr. King had a movement going in Cleveland, Ohio, back during that time. And he was trying to, along with many of the preachers there, trying to get in to see the Seal Test Dairy people, because they had milk all over the place. They had milk at the homes and all this, but they never would hire any blacks. Never would hire any black drivers, never would do anything with black people. And so Dr. King was going to get a movement going, but he wanted to see if there was some way that he could interface with these people. And they never would even meet with him. So he called me. He said, "Bob," he said, "maybe you can think of something we can do." And I said, "Yeah." I said, let me go make a trip and talk to some people. So I got on a plane and went to New York, and I talked to the chairman of the board of A&P Stores, which was the largest supermarket chain in the world at that time. And they were a client of mine. And so I told him, I said, "I think we're going to have some trouble if we don't get this thing cleaned up." And I told him what was happening. And he said, "Well, Bob, what would you recommend that we do?" I said, "I would recommend that you have one of your top guys to call the top people at Seal Test and tell them that if they don't meet with Dr. King and get this thing straightened out, that we're going to take all the Seal Test dairy products out of all the stores in the greater Cleveland, Ohio area." And so he called the fellow in, and I'm sitting there. And he says, "Hey, look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call those people, the top people at Seal Test, and tell them that if they don't meet with Dr. King, we're going to take all the sealed test dairy products out of all the stores, out of all the A&P stores in the state of Ohio, not the city. No. I told him the city, but he enlarged it to the state. Now, before the day was over, this must have been about 11 o'clock because I think we went to lunch or something after then. But that afternoon, I called back to my office and one of my secretaries tells me, he said, Mr. Brown, said, Dr. King is desperately trying to reach you. I said, oh, yeah. So he left a number. So I called him back. He's still in Cleveland. He said, Bob, I don't know what you told them people. He said, but them seal test people are burning my line up trying to meet with me. He said, I need to talk to you before I meet with them. So I told him what happened. And he said, oh, yeah, then I know how to handle it. So they went on and met with him and resolved it. But that night, the next night, they call a mass meeting at one of the biggest Baptist churches in Cleveland. And Dr. King made a speech, and he talked about this, and he talked about the seal test thing, and he talked about, he said, one of the things that the seal test people didn't know when they were dealing with us, that they didn't know that we had Bob Brown on our board of directors. And I have a tape of it. I have a tape of it in my office. I have a tape of it.
Tell us how you got to meet Nelson Mandela.
I was over in South Africa with Coretta King. She wanted to go to South Africa. And this was after Martin had died. Of course, it was killed. And she wanted to take some people with her. She wanted to see if there was an effort that could be made to help get Nelson out of jail. So I arranged a trip. I raised the money and got the trip going. And so we got to South Africa, and then she said, well, she was supposed to meet with President Porter, but the ANC and the people resisted that. So she said, well, I need to meet with Ms. Mandela. So I arranged a meeting with Ms. Mandela. So we went to Soweto, and while we were sitting there, Mrs. King asked Ms. Mandela, said, look, Ms. Mandela, if we could do anything for you all, what would the most important thing be for you and Mr. Mandela? She said immediately that the most important thing to us is getting our children out of the country and our grandchildren and let them go to school in America. She said, there are people been here who promised to do that, but nobody's ever followed through. And Coretta looks at me and she said, Bob, is there something we can do? You know, I knew she meant. Anyway, I told Ms. Mandela to write me a letter. She wrote me a letter 2 or 3 weeks later, and the rest is history. But
wait a minute, but because by we, she meant thee, right?
That's right. And so I got him over here. And on one occasion when I'm in South Africa, Ms. Mandela tells me, I'm going to petition President Porter for you to see Nelson Mandela. She said, you got his children. You're going to be the guardian of his children. You need to talk to him. You need to see what he wants. She said, that's a humanitarian thing. So I said, oh, nobody has seen Mr. Mandela except you all, and even then only 15 minutes at a time. And I said, you know, that's not going to happen, Ms. Mandela. And she said, I'm going to petition my lawyer anyway. So she told her lawyer to petition President Porter. He did that. And the night before I left, I get this call from one of President Porter's main assistants. His name was Neil Van Herten. And he said, I'm calling for President Porter. And he said, President Porter has asked me to tell you that he has granted you permission to go inside Polsmore Prison to see Nelson Mandela. And I almost dropped the telephone. I couldn't. I mean, there's no way I'm going to believe this. Nobody's seen Mr. Mandela, you know. And, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize people, nobody. I mean, they stop everybody. So anyway, I said, okay. And then he tells me what I'm supposed to do when I go there. And if there's any trouble, he gave me one of the apartheid generals to call, and he would straighten everything out. So I called Ms. Mandela to tell her, and she said, she just screamed. She said, I told you my God wouldn't let me down, Bob. So I went next morning. I've traveled down there to Cape Town, went to the prison. And when I got there, these guys had the big guns, and they were, you know, people were dying then. They were killing people. So I figured maybe this is a trick to kill me off since I'm doing all this stuff in South Africa, taking the children out of here. And the guy says, open the gate for Mr. Brown. So he told me, he said, go up there to that red big building. When I got to walk up that red big building, this big white guy comes out, and he puts his hand out. And he says, Mr. Brown, I'm the chief warden here. And I just want to shake your hand and tell you how grateful all of us here at Portsmouth Prison for you doing what you're doing for Mr. Mandela and his family. He said, I'm having him brought down from his cell now. And you just wait in that big room there and you meet with him. And you meet with him as long as you want to. I met with Mr. Mandela almost 2 hours. And nobody in 20-some years had met with him, period. That's known, except his immediate family. That's known 2 hours. And I asked him all kind of questions. He asked me questions. He told me what it would take to make peace and all this. So when I got out, wrote an extensive memo, which I sent to Ms. Mandela for the ANC. I sent it to the apartheid people. I sent it to President Reagan and to the Secretary of State. George Shultz was Secretary at the time. Yeah. George Shultz and I had worked together in the Nixon years in the Nixon White House. So, and then after that, gradually the apartheid people start speaking private to Ms. Mandela in the cell. And one thing led to another and another.
Do you think that some of what he was telling you about his plans for the future, that this was in some way a way to communicate with all of these sort of leaders about both in South Africa and obviously the rest of the world that was interested in playing a part in supporting apartheid or not, in sort of getting the word out as a kind of negotiation, do you think?
I think in the back of his mind, he felt that this might be a route that he could take. Mm-hmm. Where this word could get out, because there's no way. They're not even talking to him. How's he going to get word out? He doesn't have a phone in there. He doesn't have any kind of radios in there, any kind of communication. How's he going to get the word out? No way.
Right, and high government officials had to be careful about their, I mean, at that point, it was a sensitive negotiation.
It was
so
highly sensitive.
Secretary Shultz couldn't go in and meet with Mandela.
Oh, no. Publicly. Nobody could. They couldn't even get a visa to get in the country. They weren't giving out visas.
Robert Brown, I can't believe it. We need another hour. Either we call Robin Young over at Here and Now and ask her to cede a full hour to us, or we have you back. And I think we'll have to choose the latter because we don't have the money for a long-distance phone call. So we will ask you to come back because we never got to Richard Nixon or to Ronald Reagan or to the Kennedys, for that matter, and much, much more. We've left too much on the table, but what a pleasure to spend this hour with you, Robert Brown. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Robert Brown is the CEO and founder of BNC International in High Point, North Carolina. He's still there, and he is still running the company. We will talk more with him, I promise you, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, which is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wodarski is sitting in today. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.